Donald Trump takes center stage.
I proudly accept your nomination for president of the United States.
Plus, the International Court of Justice says Israel is violating international law.
And so this ruling is important because it makes official what we all knew to be the case. But its true importance will only exist if Western nations, in particular the United States, reacts to the ruling by forcing the Israeli government to end the occupation.
And later, an attack on Tel Aviv, Evan Gershkovich is found guilty, and President Zelensky addresses the British cabinet. Today is Friday, July 19th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll get to our top story in a moment, but first, a global computer issue is disrupting businesses around the world. Banks, hospitals, airports, media outlets, and other services that people rely on have had massive service interruptions on Friday. Problems are persisting hours after Microsoft said it was fixing an issue that affects access to Microsoft 365 apps and services. Experts believe the issue behind the outage is indeed a technical problem and not a security incident or a cyber attack. However, experts also caution that global outages like this are increasingly possible as the world relies on software from a small handful of providers. The top story, though, is the American presidential election and former President Donald Trump's Thursday night speech to the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. In his first speech since surviving an assassination attempt last Saturday, Trump accepted his party's nomination for the 2024 election. He began by striking a calm, even introspective tone as he spoke of national unity and told the audience about the shooting from his point of view. But by about halfway through the 93-minute speech, he returned to his false claims that he won the 2020 election, along with harsh statements about immigration and crime that are hallmarks of his rallies. VOA's senior Washington correspondent, Carolyn Pursuti, brings us the sights and sounds from Thursday night in Milwaukee.
I proudly accept your nomination for President of the United States.
Conventions always save their best for last. But here, even higher anticipation for the speech by the former president, given what happened 5 days ago. Donald Trump began his speech softer, subdued, and reflective about the pain he felt at Saturday's rally.
Wow, what was that? It can only be a bullet. And moved my right hand to my ear, brought it down. My hand was covered with blood.
During the convention week, this photo reminded delegates daily of their candidate, strong, resilient, not stopped by an assassin's bullet. He promised that strength to extend overseas. Trump said neither the war in Ukraine nor the Israel-Hamas conflict would have happened on his watch.
A growing specter of conflict hangs over Taiwan, Korea, the Philippines, and all of Asia, and our planet is teetering on the edge of World War III. And this will be a war like no other war because of weaponry.
He wrote his speech weeks prior, but now obvious changes, much more religious, given how close he came to death.
I stand before you in this arena only by the grace of Almighty God.
A convicted felon with 34 counts against him, Trump accused the Biden administration of weaponizing the justice system, creating high inflation, and opening the border to drugs and criminals.
We want people to come into our country, but they have to come into our country legally. The next vice president of the United States.
In the presidential box was Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, selected this week as the former president's running mate. Also, Trump's wife, Melania Trump, her first time appearing at the convention.
On this journey, I am deeply honored to be joined by my amazing wife, Melania.
Political analysts like Shannon Beau O'Brien from the University of Texas see a Republican Party with a new inclusion message.
Look how diverse we are in some ways. Look how friendly we are in some ways. look how chaotic the Democrats are. Look how unified and together we are. And we're a safer bet.
Trump did not deliver a strong message of unity, as analysts expected, but some delegates felt it.
Everyone's coming together, and, you know, we are the party of the people.
This delegate from Wisconsin wears a plastic cheese wedge as a hat.
We are so excited for this movement, for a red wave, and to get Donald Trump and J.D. Vance elected to the White House this year.
From here, the Trump-Vance ticket takes its message well beyond these delegates to Americans across the country. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News at the Republican National Convention, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
As Donald Trump reveled in the spotlight, Joe Biden is facing physical and political isolation as he deals with COVID, while more and more top Democrats urge him to step aside as the party's presidential nominee. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has that part of the story.
Republicans are pledging unity and support behind their presidential nominee, former President Donald Trump, during their national convention this week. For President Joe Biden, it's a lonelier scene. He is isolating in his home in Delaware following a positive COVID test. This amid calls from prominent Democrats for him to step down. Analysts say it's looking grim for the president. Larry Sabato, University of Virginia Center for Politics, via Skype.
Democrats can't even decide whether Biden is really in trouble or not, and if he is, how to get him out of the race, and if they get him out of the race, who should replace him and how. Now, that's pretty fundamental. Meanwhile, the Republicans have gotten their act together. They've had a great convention. And Donald Trump, because in part of the assassination attempt, probably has more public support than he ever has had.
Privately, the president is reportedly listening to concerns. Publicly, he is resisting calls to step aside.
I've demonstrated that I know how to get things done for the country, in spite of the fact that we're told we couldn't get it done. But there's more to do, and I'm reluctant to walk away from that.
65% of Democrats say Biden should step aside, according to an AP NORC poll. American University presidential historian Alan Lichtman.
It is the height of folly and ignorance to claim you know, based on the polls, which constantly change, who's going to win and who's going to lose, and you should force candidates out just because you think they can't win.
American University presidential historian Alan Lichtman's Keys to the White House System has accurately predicted all but one U.S. election results since 1984. He says Democrats should stick with Biden. Lichtman's system ignores polling, including that 70% of Americans said they are not confident that Biden has the mental capacity to be president. For Trump, it's 51%. What happens now is anybody's guess. If Biden agrees to step aside, the most orderly scenario would be for him to endorse an alternative candidate. Vice President Kamala Harris would be a logical choice, at least financially, because as part of the Biden-Harris ticket, she would inherit their campaign war chest. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
A breaking story now. Midday on Friday, the International Court of Justice in The Hague ruled that Israel is violating international law with its control in parts of East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Meanwhile, many Muslim Americans have withdrawn their support for President Biden because of his support for Israel in the war against Hamas. At the same time, though, former President Trump says he would support Israel even more. And in the past, he's implemented a travel ban targeted at Muslims trying to enter the U.S. For a look at all this, I'm joined by Edward Ahmed Mitchell. He's the Deputy Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
The ICJ is acknowledging the obvious, what's been obvious to international observers, including human rights groups, for decades. The Israeli government is blatantly violating international law by maintaining a system of apartheid, occupation and oppression over Palestinians in East Jerusalem, in the West Bank. It is illegal. It's been illegal since the war in 1967, and yet it has continued with support from the United States. And so this ruling is important because it makes official what we all knew to be the case, but its true importance will only exist if Western nations, in particular the United States, reacts to the ruling by forcing the Israeli government to end the occupation.
Well, what does stopping the occupation look like?
The official position of the United States is that it supports a two-state solution, an Israeli government governing territory pre-1967 and the Palestinian state governing territory pre-1967 with land swaps in between. Now, the problem is that the United States has not done anything to make a two-state solution a reality or even a plausibility. The Israeli government has been every year eating up more and more Palestinian land, building more and more settlements specifically to prevent a Palestinian state from coming into existence. And just days ago, the Knesset voted overwhelmingly against recognizing a Palestinian state ever.
So this is actually a great segue to American foreign policy after taking a look at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. Did Donald Trump or J.D. Vance or anyone else say anything that particularly alarmed you?
Well, let me start by saying CARE is a nonprofit civil rights organization. So we do not comment positively or negatively on political candidates, only on elected officials. What I will say, generally speaking, is that Republican elected officials have made it very clear that they are indifferent to the suffering of the Palestinian people, that they would they completely support what the Israeli government is doing to the Palestinian people, and that they support a foreign policy that is in many ways amoral, that is not based on human rights concerns or what's right or what's wrong, but rather based on raw power, what's best for American economic interests in their mind. That has, you know, been the position of many Republican elected officials, not talking about any candidates, but elected officials for many years now. My only hope is that Republican elected officials and others will take this anti-interventionist, anti-war streak they've adopted and apply it across the board, not just selectively, right? If you've got a problem with supporting war and the ongoing war in Ukraine, you want to bring that to a negotiated end. Well, that should be the same for the war on the people of Gaza. You know, our government should not be enabling injustice overseas in any way, shape, or form. We should be fighting to bring peace to the world.
One thing that struck me about J.D. Vance's speech is that he said his support for Israel was derived from his Christian faith and not necessarily any kind of political ideology. Given the history of the region, the religious tensions, the political tensions, do you have any comment on that? Is that somehow different from the war in Ukraine, for example?
What I would say is this: when the president or the vice president or members of Congress take their oath, you know, they're pledging to uphold the Constitution, and the American people expect them to pursue policies that are beneficial to our country and that are just, not to enforce their particular understanding of religion on the entire country or on our foreign policy. But having said that, what I'll say is this, that if you are a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or any religion, my understanding is that all of our faiths teach justice. All of our faiths oppose racism, oppose oppression, oppose genocide. So if you are a devout Christian, you should be at the front of the line opposing the horrific war crimes being committed against men, women, and children, and by the way, Israeli and American hostages who are at risk from this indiscriminate bombing campaign in Gaza. And so, you know, from my perspective, someone thinks that their religion, whether it's Christianity or Islam or Judaism, should lead them to support genocide, I think they need to take another look at their holy book, because that's not the Bible that I read. That's not the Quran that I read. That's not the Torah that I read.
Edward Ahmed Mitchell is Deputy Executive Director of the Council of American Islamic Relations. Sir, thanks for your analysis today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
An Iranian-made drone sent by Yemen's Houthi rebels struck central Tel Aviv on Friday, leaving one person dead and at least 10 wounded in the group's first lethal strike into Israel. The attack came hours after Israel confirmed that it had killed a senior commander of the Iran-backed Hezbollah militia in southern Lebanon. A military spokesperson for the Houthis, Yaha Sarah, said in a televised speech that the group attacked Tel Aviv and will continue to target Israel in solidarity with Palestinians. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addresses the British cabinet. We'll have that story in a moment. Now, though, with more on the situation in Israel following the ruling from the ICJ and the drone attack in Tel Aviv, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Well, the court basically said that Israel's construction of Jewish settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which has been going on since Israel occupied that area in 1967, is illegal, and that Israel should evacuate all settlements, dismantle all walls, and return any of those people who were displaced. It said that Israel has to make reparations for damages caused by the West Bank occupation. I mean, it was a pretty strong court ruling, and even though it's not binding, it will, I think it will add to Israel's diplomatic isolation, which has already been going on because of the 9 months of war. The hardliners in Israel's government reacted predictably. Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich said that this is the time that Israel should actually annex the West Bank and that the court ruling is anti-Semitic. There are, by the way, about 500,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank and another 200,000 in East Jerusalem. Israel makes a distinction between these two types of people because it annexed East Jerusalem immediately in 1967, something that it did not do with the West Bank.
So that's the reaction from the Israeli government. What about the Israeli people? We know the Israeli population is currently very divided on how they see their government. What about this?
First of all, Israelis have moved to the right since the war began in October. Since Hamas invaded Israel and took over dozens of communities and killed 1,200 people. And then the 9 months of war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza that has left more than 38,000 Palestinians killed, which includes both fighters and civilians. So the country in general has moved towards the right. So far, there hasn't been that much reaction from Israelis. I mean, this really just happened. But I think that even those Israelis who are in the center kind of feel that the international community doesn't really understand the situation that Israel is facing, that Israel hasn't annexed the settlements, and there potentially could be some sort of Palestinian state there eventually. And so I don't think we're going to see any kind of major protests against the government over this issue the way that we're seeing over, for example, the delay in signing a deal to bring back the remaining hostages in Gaza, signing a ceasefire deal.
And Linda, the other big story from Jerusalem is the Houthi attack in Tel Aviv. Can you tell us what happened there and what's the latest?
Yeah, so at 3 o'clock in the morning, a drone hit an apartment building in Tel Aviv, killing one man who was asleep in his bed. And it was a really large explosion. It was very loud. It was just a few blocks from the American consulate. And the Israeli army says that it was an Iranian upgraded drone that was fired by the Houthis in Yemen. The Houthis also took responsibility. There were press reports in Saudi Arabia saying there were several other drones that were shot down, that the United States shot down. But this drone had been flying for several hours. I mean, you're talking about 2,000 kilometers, which is something like 1,200 miles from Yemen to Tel Aviv. And I think it has kind of shocked a lot of people, and they don't understand like why Israel didn't shoot it down. Israel sort of not characteristically came out with a statement very quickly saying that it was human error, that there were no sirens sounded, and that it was not shot down as other drones have been and similar attacks. But I think it kind of made people feel a little bit unsafe and a little bit nervous. I mean, this is Tel Aviv. This isn't the border with Gaza.
VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on these topics today.
Thank you, Steve.
Following up on a story from Thursday's show, we told you about Evan Gershkovich, the American journalist imprisoned in Russia and accused of espionage. Well, a Russian court found him guilty on Friday and has sentenced him to 16 years in prison. VOA's Steve Miller has more.
The conclusion of Gershkovich's swift and secretive trial in a country's highly politicized legal system perhaps clears the way for a prisoner swap between Moscow and Washington. Gershkovich, his employer, and the U.S. government vehemently deny the charges. State Department deputy spokesperson Verdant Patel on Thursday declined to discuss negotiations about a possible exchange, but said, quote, "We have been clear from the get-go. Evan did nothing wrong and should not have been detained, end quote. Russian President Vladimir Putin hinted earlier this year that he would be open to swapping Gerskovich for Vadim Krasikov, a Russian serving a life sentence for the 2019 killing in Berlin of a Georgian citizen of Chechen descent. Steve Miller, VOA News.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is still in England and addressed the cabinet on Friday. Zelensky is also reported to be planning a phone conversation with former U.S. President Donald Trump. VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the details.
On Friday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky attended a special meeting of the British government. He became the first foreign leader to address a ministerial meeting since 1997. During the meeting, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer promised his country would double its support for Ukraine. Starmer also said that Ukraine has the unwavering support of Great Britain and that Russia's aggression is unforgivable and cannot go unpunished. In turn, Volodymyr Zelensky appealed to Keir Starmer with a request to help Ukraine get permission to use Western-made long-range weapons for strikes deep into Russia. According to the Ukrainian leader, if restrictions are lifted, it will help Kyiv strengthen its defenses, destroy weapon centers inside Russia, and defend against Moscow's aggression.
We must deprive Putin of money and capability to produce more weapons, and for his disregard of human life, he must pay with his losses and his defeat. How can we ensure this? Right now we are missing the main answer to this question, and that is our long-range capability. By defending Ukraine against the Russian advance on Kharkiv in May, June, we have proven that we can stop any Russian attempt to expand the war.
Meanwhile, according to CNN, U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky may hold a telephone conversation on Friday. This will be their first conversation since Trump left the White House. Trump has repeatedly said he could end the war in Ukraine in one day, but it remains unclear how he intends to do so. Recently, Trump stated that he would have told the Kremlin ruler Vladimir Putin never, never enter Ukraine. Trump's staff said that the priority of his potential second term as U.S. president would be to end the war between Russia and Ukraine as soon as possible. During his recent speech at the Republican convention, Trump mentioned Ukraine, saying that the world is on the verge of World War III and promised to change the situation again without saying how. Zelensky said that interaction with Donald Trump in the event of his re-election to the post of U.S. president will be difficult work, but Ukraine is ready to cooperate effectively with whoever will be in power in the U.S. A previous phone call between Trump and Zelensky led to Donald Trump's first impeachment, as it appeared to many that Trump tried to withhold aid to Ukraine until Zelensky could send him information to use against the Biden family. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.